episode.
For Asian listeners, today is October 28th. I'm David Rothberg, chairman of Niagara Capital Partners, and with me is Albert Friedberg, the portfolio manager of the Friedberg. Good morning, Albert.
Good morning.
We'll conduct our call today as we usually do. I'm going to put some general questions to Al to begin, and then we'll respond to questions. If any listeners have a question that you would like to put to us, you may do so by emailing it to Mike Hammond, and he'll forward all questions to me, and I'll put them to Albert. Mike's email address is mhammond, M-H-A-M-M-O-N-D, at niagaracapital.ca. That's M-H-A-M-M-O-N-D at niagaracapital.ca. Al, let's begin with where we stand today. The global macro universe today is unusually discordant. On one hand, you have guys like Muriel Rubini and Mark Rosenberg seeing overcapacity and slack labor markets breeding deflation. S&P at 400, Treasury bonds well bid, et cetera. On the other hand, you have the Mark Faber camp that sees the budget deficit ultimately breeding a horrible inflation. Ergo, you should avoid bonds, own stocks, and commodities. You agree with neither camp, and yet you've got the global macro fund positioned as though you were an inflationist. You've got, and I'm going to outline the positions that you have now. You have about 75% of the NAV dependent upon a commodity trade. That's to say that if commodities were to rise or to fall by 1%, the NAV of the fund would change by 75 basis points. The majority of that is in gold, and then you have a diversified book, and then another book that's fairly concentrated in metals on the LME. In addition to the commodity story, you have a fairly strong equity bet on in the form of China equities, about a quarter of them in the H shares. And then in addition to that, you have a fairly substantial TIPS trade. You also have some long exposure to U.S. equities in the form of two insurance companies, which began as a distress trade. What's the story? Where are you standing today?
Well, that's thanks, David. That's right. I wouldn't say that we are looking for massive inflation, and I don't think that the other side of the argument that we are looking at deflation is at the moment the right view. I think that the key here is the very low rate of interest that prevails in the U.S. and in Europe and in Japan, especially in the U.S., where instead of fostering, instead of promoting the savings, we are trying to, in whichever way possible, we're trying to promote more spending. And so the U.S. adjustment, which in global terms would be, let's say, a current account adjustment, is not taking place. We've gone through a very severe recession. We're still probably in it, but coming out of it. And yet, we're still running a fairly large deficit on current account. So it is the inappropriate policy for the U.S., at least from a monetary point of view, to be so accommodative. And very low rates of interest are causing this huge run into assets. So I'm not sure that we're looking at a huge run-up in inflation or what we call sustained inflation. I'm pretty sure that we're looking at a run-up in asset prices, commodity prices, and security prices. And that, of course, will change once interest rates are brought back to more normal levels. So for now, the position that we have taken is that we should participate in those type of markets. We should be long commodities still. We should be long some securities. We prefer the Asian story because the Asian markets, the Asian economies are much more robust than the Western, at least in the U.S. and in Europe. They're getting the inflow of all those dollars. Therefore, their own money growth has been very strong, and we are likely to get to see very inflated prices in Asia because of this easy monetary policy of the U.S. It is transmitted there. And it's within the context of a strong economy, a good rebound. So we want to be there, and I think the best representation, the best place to be, we think, in that space is Hong Kong shares, especially the H shares, which still trade at a discount to their counterparts in the mainland. And we've talked about that in our shareholders letter at length. So. That's really our position. We want to participate in this recession of asset prices. We are not yet, at any rate, making a bet on the inflation side. We're not making a bet that it's going to get out of hand, and we're not making a bet on the deflation side. We're simply saying asset prices are still likely to move out. Now, in recent days, we've had a bit of increase in risk, probably a result of a combination of various things, but the overall model remains the same. The overall scenario to us remains the same. Money is very, very cheap, and that's causing all these security prices and commodity prices to rise. So that's really the short and long of it. There's very little new in our position. We built this portfolio back in first quarter of the year. We basically stood with it. Had a bit of a hard time in the first 6 months of the year, and it's gotten a little better in the third quarter. And we think that it will continue to do okay for the next 3 to 6 months.
What threatens the view, what threatens the portfolio as it's constructed today?
Well, yeah, the threat comes from if and when the central banks, at least the central banks of the United States and Europe, decide to raise interest rates, bring them back to more normal levels. I think I mentioned this last time. I believe that the U.S. made a colossal mistake. The U.S. Federal Reserve made a colossal mistake by lowering rates to where they did. Their main objective during the crisis was to provide liquidity, as much liquidity as the market needed. And that liquidity could have been provided via any level of rates. It could have been done at 6%, it could have been done at 5%, 4%, but they chose to provide the liquidity at very low rates, like 0.5% and 0.25%. Now, that runs contrary to all tenets of central banking. I mean, we know that the right way to do this is, and we know that from writings of the 19th century, that the way to take care of a liquidity crisis, if indeed there was only a liquidity crisis, it probably was more than that, was a solvency crisis too, but the way to take care of a liquidity crisis is to lend freely, to lend abundantly, but to lend at penalty rates, so that those who made mistakes would pay for their mistakes. Instead, we lend abundantly and freely, but at cheap rates, and we subsidize all the losers, all those who made mistakes.
I think you're quoting from the famous book Lombard Street, are you?
Lombard Street, right. So we committed two mistakes. One of them is we subsidized these losers. But secondly, we also put ourselves in a box, because what we did is by lowering rates to where they are now, the exit is a lot more difficult. If the Fed will have to go back, and eventually they will have to go back to more reasonable long-term rates, it is difficult to do that, because as you begin to talk about rising rates, the market now starts getting nervous. And you may end up actually doing far more damage on the exit side or when you exit than you would have if you would just have stayed at the same interest rate as before. So the whole scenario, this whole picture of rising asset prices is dependent on cheap money. As prices rise faster and faster, it will require probably higher rates of interest, so that maybe 2% would not be sufficient, and maybe 4% would not be sufficient. I don't know, but when it does happen, I think that the party will be near its last stages, and depending on how high it will go, the party will be over. It is interesting that in the U.S., for instance, we've had a huge decline in commercial credit, bank credit. I think in the past 18 weeks, bank credit has dropped something like $400 billion. And money supply has not been affected as much because the banks have been buying treasuries. So they have been building up a lot of liquidity. But what is interesting is that the banks are almost paralyzed and in providing credit. And this says that we are still in an environment, a high-risk environment, and it's an environment in which the Fed is not likely to move quickly. It's going to be very careful and probably is going to be late on pushing the button. Nevertheless, we think that because that's the risk, we started already taking some protection by betting that short-term interest rates will begin to rise. So we have started, for instance, selling Eurodollar futures, Eurodollar interest rate futures, back the back months, late next year, as a way to protect ourselves in case the Fed changed. And just as an example, I think that those December 10 Eurodollar interest rates are trading something at discounting at 1.6 or 1.7 rate compared to 0.30 today for euros. So they're building already a 140 basis point increase.
But you're guaranteed to lose in the event that they do.
You're going to lose a lot of money if in the event that the rates stay the same or don't go up by 140 basis points.
It's an insurance premium.
Yeah, but what we have taken that into account, and we said, okay, we're happy if we lose that, because if that happens, our commodity position and our security positions will do very well. So we have begun to take some protection, and as in every case that you take protection, when you buy insurance, fire insurance, you don't hope that a fire happens, but it is just an insurance. The same thing here. I think the position that we're taking now in interest rates is one which we are paying a steep insurance premium, but we think it's worthwhile. The real question is, how much insurance do we need? But that's something that we have to deal with.
I'd like to talk briefly about each of the pockets in the fund, or at least each of the main issues in each of the pockets. And I'd like to start with stocks that you hold in the Global Opportunities pocket. You are friendly to Asian stocks, and yet you're not friendly to U.S. stocks. Are we starting to emerge from a one-story type of investment environment? And by that I mean an investment environment whose single story last year was credit crisis, and whose single story this year so far has been risk trade. Are we starting now to move from a take risk or don't take risk environment into a murkier environment, a more complex environment, a more nuanced environment? An environment that may be a little bit more difficult to trade.
Well, I'm not sure about more difficult to trade, but I do see a dichotomy opening up. I don't think it's possible. I mean, what we have seen, let's put it this way, what we have seen in the past 7 or 8 months is we have seen rising stock prices and rising commodity prices, almost across the board, almost all over the world.
And a falling dollar.
And a falling dollar. I don't think that a falling dollar and rising commodity prices are entirely compatible with rising stock prices, at least not in North America. So I think that this joint move, this almost indiscriminate move, it will at some point end. And I'm betting that most probably the U.S. stock market will be the one that will underperform in this kind of a scenario. So that cheap money will continue to push higher Asian markets and maybe commodity prices, but it will not be enough to sustain U.S. stock prices for a variety of other reasons too. But it's not something that that this market here can take easily. So the first stage was kind of indiscriminate. Everything went up, and in fact, if you look, you'll find that the things that went down the most and that had a justification for going down the most went up the most, rebounded the fastest. And so we had some crazy things happening in the market where stocks that were given up for dead practically had spectacular gains. But that will change, and I think the overall market will change at some point, and we'll find that it's not the right place to be, the U.S. market, and maybe even not the European market. And if you want to be in equities, you have to be in other places. You have to be in places like China.
Hey, looking at the on a China theme, looking at the currency pockets, you were earlier in the year trading dollars from the long side and losing money, and now you're short dollars against a variety of emerging currencies. Can you explain the arc of your thinking there?
And happily, we are making money. So,
and happily,
we're losing money, and now we're making money. Which okay. My feeling was, in the earlier part, was that the U.S. dollar, and I still think that that's the case, the U.S. dollar is cheaply priced when compared to many other currencies, and that from a value point of view, the U.S. dollar is in a value zone, and in fact, it's been in an area where, for the past 30 years almost, it bounced off that level in real terms. So the U.S. dollar is relatively cheap, and so my feeling was, you know, you should be long dollars at these levels. The problem is that this cheap money policy, this extreme cheap money policy, is now causing havoc because it's inflating its central bank reserves all over the world, and there is a feeling that a lot of those dollars are not wanted anymore. Central bank reserves, at least a proportion of dollars in central bank reserves, has been declining. I think the latest numbers that I have are something under 62%. They were 68%, they were 70%. That means that on a flow basis, I mean, that's a stock assessment, on a flow basis, one would have to believe that central banks are keeping only a very small proportion of the incoming dollars if they're not turning them into something else, like euros or something else. Or sending it into sovereign funds, and the sovereign funds are buying equities or buying commodities or whatever they're doing. The point is that there's a surplus dollar, there's a surplus of dollars, there's a large amount of unwanted dollars starting to pressure markets, and so that's changed now, the fundamentals. You know, you do have a valuation that's reasonable, but you now have a surplus of dollars that is going to be pressuring this market for a long time to come, and it's dangerous, potentially dangerous. And so sometime in the last few months, we decided, you know what, the flow argument is stronger than the valuation argument, and that's always been the case. You know, valuation can only give you a general broad range of value, but it won't tell you exactly where the bottom is. The flow argument is real, is here. We know it's happening. We know that the U.S. is still running a current account deficit. We know that the U.S. is probably running an investment deficit now. There is at least a much smaller surplus than it was before. Foreigners are still buying U.S. Securities, but there is a much smaller surplus on that account. So we have pressure, and the dollar can go anywhere. And until the interest rates are raised, I think the dollar can continue to weaken, and therefore one should be taking advantage of that. And that's what we did, actually. We moved from being long dollars to being neutral and then going short dollars, not in a big way, but we think in a prudent way.
And your short dollars, as is typically the case with you, not against euro, not against the majors, but against emerging currencies.
Yeah, we prioritize some of the emerging currencies. For instance, one of the currencies that we bet on was the Polish zloty, because we felt that that had more dynamic potential than the euro, a little bit more risk, but more potential than the euro. And we bought, for instance, Indonesia rupiahs, which, again, there we think that it's a carry story because their interest rates are much higher, but it's also a good story. It's a story of a country that is that is doing a lot of right things and attracting a lot of investments, and with relatively good governance, and certainly better governance than it's had for in its history, practically. And so that's another way that we played it. And then we did something else too. We thought commodity prices are headed higher. There's a way we can take advantage of that. And here I'm a little bit hesitant because, you know, we try not to duplicate the risk. So we actually took that into account. We went long Aussie and short pounds, sort of a bet on the commodity prices will do well and a bet that the British monetary policy is a disaster. And so it was a double bet. In some sense, though, we are conscious, though, that the Aussie play, or at least half of the trade, is commodity based, and we are already making that bet in other parts of the portfolio. So we took that into account. We didn't make a big bet, but it's a bet that has worked out very well. Especially the pound side has done very well. The pound side on the short side of the pound. That's
you. Sorry, I didn't mean to
interrupt. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say that also in the currency area, you have a long yuan play, and in the form of calls on the yuan. Are you expecting a revaluation of the yuan, and how does that play into the other parts of the portfolio? I'm thinking in particular of the Chinese equity position that you have in your global pocket.
Yeah, yeah. We do have call options on the yuan. They're cheap at the moment. They were cheap when we put them on anyway. And it was a cheap bet that something would happen there. It may or may not, but the yuan has depreciated quite a bit in the recent few months against trade weighted basket, especially as depreciated a great deal against the euro. And even though it maintains a strong stance against other Asian currencies. We think that the yuan has a good chance of being folded up again, as they did from 2005 to 2007, and these call options should do well. But our most hopeful scenario is that they will actually open the capital account and let the yuan float fairly freely. As a way to present, as a way to prepare as a way, not to prepare, but as a way to introduce the yuan as a reliable, credible, strong currency, something that other central banks can or may wish to own. Certainly Asian banks who trade a great deal with China. So it would be politically and economically a good move for them to begin opening that capital account, allow the yuan to float a bit. Should that happen, we would make money on those calls, but we also make money on the H shares that we own in Hong Kong, or that are trading at a substantial discount because of the inability of the market to arbitrage A and H, the A shares that trade in China, the H that trade in Hong Kong. So we think that that's a logical move. It may or may not happen, but in the meantime, we still are benefiting from a general rise in Hong Kong shares. But that is in our currency portfolio too, one calls.
We've spent probably enough time talking about currencies, but I want to put to you one final issue. You've said that a threat to the entire scenario is that the Fed will respond probably too late, but as a consequence of their being too late, probably too dramatically to monetary stimulus by raising rates very sharply. And you were looking like a hunter at what events might inspire the Fed to do that. And one of the things that you mentioned, I'm thinking about a conversation the two of us had about a month ago, was the euro at 155. Another one was gold at 12 or 1300. Could the dollar decline? Do you see the dollar declining to that level in the not too distant future, in the foreseeable future? And do you think that in the event that that were to happen, that in fact that would precipitate a rate rise?
Yeah, I'm not sure the Fed looks so much at currencies. For sure, the European Central Bank is concerned and has already expressed a concern with 150. They may put some pressure if it gets much above that 150. I think that the U.S., the Fed would be more concerned if things like the price of oil would go up more, the price of gold would go up a great deal, or commodities in general that would pressure the CPI. Again, let me say this: the threat, when we call it the threat, I mean the threat to our position, the threat to the reflation trade, is that the Fed will raise rates. If they raise it sharply, of course, the threat will be even greater. I believe that they will be late. At least it looks like they will be late, given what's happening in the banking area. They're closing banks every week. Now we have 107 banks. They're probably closing 3 to 5 banks a week. Credit is falling very quickly. Bank credit is falling. So it's not very likely that the central bank, the U.S. central bank, will raise rates quickly. And yes, there is a danger. Again, a danger to our position. Not necessarily a danger to medium and long-term world prosperity, but a danger to our position, that the Fed will raise rates quickly when they finally do it. But I think the trigger is not going to be so much currencies as much as a very strong move in commodity prices, or some pressure by buyers, foreign buyers of our treasuries. And if we start seeing that China and India and all the countries that buy, and Korea and all the countries that buy our debt refuse to come to the auctions because of the fall in the dollar and because the yield curve is much too steep, the Fed may be galvanized into action. So that's the threat, at least a threat to our position. Yes, it may happen that it will be done in a crisis environment, in a panic-type environment, and then the Fed will have to raise rates very quickly. We have a historical analog where in the late 70s, 78, I think it was 78, 79, the Fed was forced to raise rates because the dollar was falling. I mean, that was, it's a very unusual thing, but the Fed actually, it's unusual because the dollar was floating, so there was no impact on reserves, and yet the Fed raised rates very sharply, and then the Fed raised rates again very sharply in the early 80s. At that time, it wasn't so much a question of the weak dollar, but it's much more the inflation rate. So we know that that's possible, and we have to be attentive to that.
Okay, talk a little bit about tips. I don't think that any conversation with you is complete until we've talked about Treasury inflation-protected securities. You have them in your bond portfolio. It constitutes about 28%, if I'm not mistaken, of the entire fund, and it represents 100% of the commitment of the bond portfolio. Can you talk a little bit about tips, please?
Yeah, tips are probably the best security to own today because, from a credit point of view, there is no credit risk, and from an inflation point of view, we don't really know what will happen to inflation. But chances are, given the way politicians are, chances are that inflation will be a problem for the next 10, 15, 20, 50 years. The question is when to own them and when not to own them. And for instance, right now, just to look at it very simplistically, the break-evens, which is the implicit premium, the market's way of saying what the estimate, the market's estimate of what inflation will be for the next 10 years, 20 years, the break-even between that and nominal bonds, is today below the rate of inflation that we are presently experiencing on a core basis, unadjusted, meaning CPI, unadjusted, not adjusted by, unadjusted meaning, CPI, adjusted by the fact that you don't want to take into account volatile food prices, for instance, and energy prices, and you just look at inflation, what's called the underlying inflation rate, is something like 0.2% a month. That works out to, if you compound it, to 2.5, 2.6, 2.7% a year. That is the underlying rate of inflation. And this is in the midst of a recession. Break-evens for 5 years, 10 and 20 years, are below that 270 basis points. The market is saying that the underlying rate of inflation will be lower over the next 5 years, over the next years, over the next 20 years, than the 2.7% a year. Now that's a very aggressive bet that the market is making, because we went through a recession. We went through a very difficult recession. If we come out of this recession, it's unlikely that the inflation rate will be lower than the 0.2% a month. And so where the market thinks that that's good, that will be the average rate for the next 20 years, I don't know. But as long as those tips trade at break-even levels that are below the ongoing rate of inflation, I think they're a good deal. And it's only when they start trading at a premium that I would say, you know what, we have to be careful. If they start trading at 300 basis points, break-even levels for 5 years, or 400 basis points for a 20-year tip, then the onus of the proof, we have to prove that will be the case, and therefore it's a lot harder to own those bonds. For now, I think that they are safe, and they're likely to provide a very, very interesting return. I mean, we're not talking about great returns in these days, but if you get 6, 7, 8% a year, that's not bad. And when the break-evens begin to reflect a more aggressive rate of inflation, then we'll probably get out.
Thank you. got time for a couple of questions. I got one that just was delivered to my inbox here by Mike. Let me put it to you, Al. It's, what role do political, do geopolitical events, such as the Iranian nuclear threat, have on the portfolio?
It could have a very profound effect, and let me expand it a little bit. If we had an Iranian conflict, if we had an actual military, if we had actual military action there, chances are that deliveries of oil from that area would be blocked, and there would be quite a bit of fear in the market, and nearby prices of oil would have a large up move. It depends how long that situation lasts. If it lasts a long time, it could have a very profound effect. But assuming that it only lasts 3 months or 6 months, it still would have an effect on prices. And then I think that you have to make a difference here. If it's a short term impact, then I think that the course of commodity prices, especially of oil, will not be affected greatly. If it's longer, it will affect long term plans. Like, for instance, it will affect this whole move towards electric cars and hybrid cars. It will accelerate the move towards that. And I think that as we accelerate the move towards that, it may be the death knell of the oil market. I think we are rapidly approaching the point at which, rapidly is relative, right? I mean, rapidly in terms of world history, approaching the point at which the world will be able to do without oil, without a lot of oil, and I think that will have an impact. And the best way to bring about that change would be another large increase in price that would shock the world. And if it came because of a military conflict, then it will happen because of that. I mean, you can have a price in the hundreds, and the market will be shocked. And I think the plans to make transitions will accelerate rapidly. So that's a long term effect. Short term, as I say, it can have an impact on the price of oil, and maybe can have an impact on prices like a price of gold, for example. So. Yes, geopolitical events can have an impact. The same thing would be in the U.S. For instance, if we pass all these bills that the Obama administration wants to pass, they will have an impact. Those are political decisions. They will have an impact on production, on productivity, on growth, on profits, and therefore will have some impact in the long run on equity prices. We do have to pay some attention to them. In fact, they're probably more important today than some of the economic news that we get every day, which I don't believe are that significant from a trading point of view.
We have time for one more. This is from an investor in Switzerland. He remarks that in your third quarter report, you acknowledge that the short side of your portfolio and the equity hedge pocket went up by 27% versus the 15% rise in the S&P. And he wants to know if that indicates to you that the recent rally in stocks is unhealthy and overdone and that some correction is to be expected. He wants to know how that would affect your position, and would it not also result in a rebound in the dollar, triggering stop losses in the carry trades, and the gold, would it not affect the gold price as well?
Okay, it's a very long and complex question. Let me start with the first part, which is the short side of our portfolio went up 27%. The long side went up 26 or 27% too, so we lost a little bit of money there. But the reason the going up 27%, which went up more than market, and where we thought that we were selling stocks that were overvalued, it reflects this move that I mentioned earlier, the move that the market had, which is a very indiscriminate move. And in fact, it was a move that saw stocks that had gone down the most go up the most, the rebound effect. So that, I think, is going to be changing. I mean, we've had enough of a bounce in the market now that we can begin to see now a bifurcation here. The better companies will do better, relatively speaking, than these half dead beats. Anyway, so that's one effect, and that doesn't speak about the market. I think doesn't say anything about the market. I think it just says that we had a bounce from a very oversold condition. It's not necessarily an indicator of the market. I'm more concerned with other factors that are going to create a problem for the U.S. stock market. Secondly, as I said before, a falling U.S. stock market does not have to cause the dollar to go up. In other words, this is the common paradigm right now, which is we have what's called either risk trade or non-risk trade, and when there's risk and the U.S. stock market goes down, the dollar goes up. That paradigm, I think, is basically on its way out. And from here on, we're going to see markets move according to their fundamentals. And you can have the U.S. stock market going down, and you can have the U.S. dollar going down too, for some of the same reasons. And you can have foreign markets go up at the same time, and commodity prices still go up. So I wouldn't combine, and I wouldn't couple these two events.
Okay, I thank you very much, Al. Just to summarize, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the portfolio remains on the same course that you set for it in early 2009. It's a reflation bet. It's not an inflation bet. It's trying to capture flows for as long as they exist and trying to anticipate an end to these flows by starting to assemble a short position in euro interest rate futures, euro dollar interest rate futures. Still a concentration in commodities, Asian equities, treasury inflation protected securities, and a short dollar position against a variety of emerging economies. I thank you very much for your time, Al, and I wish you and all investors listening good luck in the coming quarter.
Thank you, David. Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye.